So I don't think this will take very long. Most of what I'm going to say is pretty generic. But I'll just give you the background about the code that we have that has been worked on a lot by Colin and Elliot Holtham, who's just joined the group, is going to be talking about some of the results. So our 3DMT code was actually a bit of an offshoot of work that we've done for the mining consortium with respect to control source. And it follows along in a kind of same generic manner. We're going to use a finite volume for solving the 3D forward problem, and we're going to use a standard Gauss-Newton for the inversion. And the primary references here are run from Colin. Does it have a pointer? Two things. It's an extended abstract. We never did really get a full-blown paper on this. And then a lot of the work that's been done in our forward modeling has been due to Eldad Haber, who was with me as a PhD student and as a research associate and is currently at Emory University, and Uri Asher, who's in computing science, and this is one of his graduate students. Just to refresh your memory, I just want to quickly go through the forward modeling because that's kind of at the heart of everything. So here's the equations that Colin talked about last time, and we had the boundary conditions that tangential H is equal to zero. We use an A5 formulation so that E is a vector potential plus the gradient of the scalar. We've got the Helmholtz gauge here. So if we discretize in a finite volume, we get this system of equations. And we're going to use a finite volume, as Colin talked about yesterday, on a staggered grid. So H is going to be on the edges and E is on the faces. So if we use that finite volume and we discretize, now we get a system of equations that looks like this, where this is A5, here's our J, E is our impressed current, and that's the divergence of it. So we end up having this forward system of equations that we need to solve. And we're going to solve that using BICG STAB, and then we're going to use a preconditioner that's just got the upper diagonal elements of things. So that's really the forward problem, and I just want to refresh your memory because this is where all the work is done in the inverse problem. It's how well you can solve that forward problem that makes all the difference. So our inversion problem is set up in the standard manner here. We've got beta as a Tikhonov regularization. This is our model objective function, and this is the misfit. So our misfit function does work on a datum by datum basis, where this is the forward model. So that would be the observed minus the predicted. And WD would be 1 over the standard deviations of the data. So we're going to try to really estimate what the standard deviation of each datum is and then just use an L2 norm measure of that. And the forward model data would be some function of these variables, potentials that we get. So the data could be an impedance, they could be an amplitude of impedance, they could be an apparent resistivity or phase. We always have some way of obtaining them from the potentials. Our model objective function does have a reference model in. From my perspective, this guy is crucial. This whole objective function here is not just, it's not just a way to regularize the problem. It's the engine that really is a major part of your inverse problem. And we spend a great deal of time trying to figure out exactly what it is we want to, how we want to tailor this. So it's generically set up so that we make a model that's close to a reference model, and we also minimize derivatives in the x, y, and z direction. But in fact, especially as we get into more detailed problems with respect to the mining industry, where things are really known, it's very good to have additional weightings and functionality in here to put in your a priori information to get out something that is as close as possible to all your geologic and geophysical data. So this thing is not to be underestimated, and two of the biggest time sinks in the inverse problem are trying to estimate what reasonable values are for the data, or the data errors, and secondly, what do we really know about the geology of the rock properties to generate this objective function. That's a lot of setup time, but your results will depend crucially upon those two things and if you want to work with them. So we're going to set up the problem to just as a Gauss-Newton problem. So we're going to find a set of model parameters, which in our case will be the log of the conductivities. And we differentiate that previous objective function, and we get a gradient that looks like this. J is our sensitivity matrix. So the J is the change in the datum with respect to a model parameter. And fortunately, we can write it in a product of matrices that we know. There's a matrix G, which is the partial derivative of the forward modeling matrix times the known vector U divided by M. And then A is our forward modeling matrix. So every time you see an A minus 1, that means you've got to do a forward modeling operation. And Q is our projection matrix. And S is related to the particular kind of data that you have. In other words, if you've got a datum that's not an electric field or not a magnetic field, then F is going to be some function of those, and you might have to take some square roots or absolute values or something like this, or maybe it's a pair of pieces. So this is now standard. We've got a gradient. We want to make that equal to zero. So at this point, we'll make a linearized approximation, so a Gauss-Newton approximation, to say that the perturbed forward model, the perturbed data is equal to the data we were at times the sensitivity that we all know. If we put all that in, we get this Hessian matrix on the left-hand side. Model perturbation is equal to the gradient. And our goal is to solve that. So fortunately, the sensitivity matrix can be written as a product of individual matrices, and most of these are sparse, and gradient is there. So the thing that really saves us is the ability to write things in this manner, the fact that everything is sparse. And I want to show you how that comes into place. We've got this system that we want to solve, so we'd like to have a preconditioner for this, and then we're going to use a conjugate gradient solution to solve that whole system. For the work I'm going to show you now, we're still using an old preconditioner, which looks of this form here. We'll eventually get around to upgrading that, but that's what's used. No, particularly. Just we want to have some influence of the J transpose J in there, so we put that in. But in the work that we've been doing in the time domain, we've actually generated a limited memory quasi-Newton estimate for the Hessian. That turned out not to be good enough for the inversion, but we're using that as a preconditioner for this. And that actually works really nicely. So we're going to... I must tell you that, we haven't done anything on this code since Colin was at UBC, and that was in 2002. So it's been a long time. This code's kind of been sitting on the shelf, and it's only... And partly because of Alan's impetus here, and also because the mining industry is becoming more interested in magnetotellurics, that we're kind of getting back into it. And we're at a stage where over the last 5 years we've done a lot of things in control source that have been significant improvements. So we're now really kind of ready to put all those things back into the MT problem here. And that's why I'm so pleased to be at this workshop, because I think by the end of this we'll have a good idea about okay, what are the things that we really where's the bottlenecks here? Where's the weak links? What should we really be doing? And then Elliot's back there. He's going to put it all together. Maybe in a year from now, we'll be able to show you a few other things.
Do you solve that very accurately, or only just a few concrete gradient steps each time?
Right now, we're limiting to about 10. So that's sort of okay, but we'd like to do better. And here again, when I talk about improvements, the major improvement that we'll get is if we solve this with direct solvers, and then we'll be able to do a much better job at this. So lots of things to do. The point I want to make about this is that we're going to solve this with conjugate gradient techniques. So for people who are familiar with that, that means multiplying this matrix on the left onto a vector on the right. Now the W's are sparse, so multiplying them onto a vector is no problem. J multiplying on a vector, remember J was this concatenation of matrices, but it's got this A minus 1 here. So every time I want to multiply J times a vector, I actually have to do a forward modeling. Every time I want to multiply J transpose times a vector, I've got to do another forward modeling. Randy's question was, well, how many times, how many conjugate gradient iterations do you use in solving this problem? And I said, well, 10. But even if we do 10 iterations, that means we've got 20 forward modelings for this and another one for the gradient. So you've got 21 forward modelings just to solve this once. That gives you a perturbation delta M, and then generally we do a line search on that to upgrade M. So that's the computations. It's all in that. The faster that you can make all this stuff work, the more efficient your algorithm can be. This basically, what we do, this is really standard. So here's the objective function that we're solving. We choose a starting beta. So Greg said it correctly. I mean, if you're going to start off, you want to be at a location where you have a very high value of beta, so that you've got basically a linear quadratic system to solve. That'll put you right close to that Tikhonov curve. And then evaluate the objective functions and the gradient. But we still have to choose beta. So we start with a high value of beta, and then we have a cooling loop where we progressively choose to lower beta as a function of time. And so for each value of beta, then you've got a number of interior steps here which you want to minimize a particular objective function for a specific value of beta. Once you finish that, then you reduce beta a little bit more and you gradually decrease. So that's our algorithm, and I'm just going to show you one example. We'll see some more realistic ones later. This is actually a pretty small example. It's one that was done quite a few years ago when we distributed the code, so I thought I'd just keep it. So it's a block in a half space. Dimitri, you said you've been working for a long year on a problem. I thought a year was long. We've been working on block and half space for probably about 2 decades.
Do you have t-shirts?
Yeah. So your didn't sound so bad to me. So it's a conductive block, 1 ohm meter, 200 ohm meter background. We've got a whole bunch of stations. In fact, there's 1,600 stations. Number of data is 13,000. Well, it doesn't matter. I mean, having extra data is no problem. It's the number of cells, right? So there's really not very many cells. Here's what the data look like. So now we have chosen. Here was our explicit rule. We didn't know what realistic data errors would be. So we said, okay, we're going to take apparent resistivities, and we're going to say our error is 5% for that, and well as 2 degrees in the phase, and then we converted that back through to the impedances. So that's how we got these values. So here's our different impedance values, sort of real and imaginary, the x components, the xy, yx, and yy. So these numbers, you probably can't see them very well, but they are in fact smaller than the off-diagonal elements, but they are appreciable. And we invert those data. We get out what is traditionally seen. There's a block here. The white outline indicates the outside of the block. So you've got this smoothing on the boundaries and extension down the depth. The observed and predicted values look like this. So we've done a good job at the data. And here's our curve. So you'll see a couple of curves that look like this. So this is the initial misfit. This number should come down to 1,344, which was the number of, or 13,000, which was the number of data that we had. And what we see here, each time we change data, first iteration, we get a really large decrease. As beta cools, and sometimes it takes a couple of extra values, but we're gradually plateauing off. This is actually a pretty conservative distribution. Interestingly enough, it goes along here a little bit without making very much progress, and then kind of grabs a hold of it. So in this particular example, 55 iteration.
Do you know what happened there, though, between iteration 42 and 43? What caused that?
I don't know. Sometimes it just seems to kind of stall out a little bit, and then it'll pick things up.
Smith thing of getting rid of charge buildup?
No, there's nothing here. I'm not sure if you're
good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much to make any progress,
we didn't, I mean, interestingly enough, we didn't get any additional, there's three drops in the beta, 1, 2, 3, actually there's four drops there. And then finally beta got small enough and it just grabbed a hold of something. But why it actually behaves in that kind of plateau manner.
Well, I think it just gets hard to, I mean, you get close to the minimum and it's not quite there, but it's hard to find it. And in fact, John Booker shows me an example. Of course, he likes to run about 1,000 iterations, but you often you can keep making progress little by little. Do a good job, but then you make minor changes, and it'll go along, and then you'll just do that. And finally finds where to go down.
It's kind of marching along the side of a valley,
yeah,
and
like
then
along
finally
along
gets
that
oh,
valley,
oh,
and
then
it just
there
can't
we go down.
Quite
down.
Find where to go. Yeah.
You can do a model and keep hyperspace go right ahead. But the
It's really interesting. We, for a decade and a half, we basically used that approach, that sort of a two-stage Parker approach to finding beta and letting it go, letting it adjust at each iteration, and it worked really well. Okay. Then the numerical community, kind of en masse, kind of went to this. The cooling, most of the theoretical results that came out from numerical optimization were kind of all on this, on the cooling schedule. And, we just, okay, well, let's just try that. And then that kind of got built into our other codes. But one of the things that I really would like to do here is go back and investigate exactly this problem and to take this result, recode it up to do the Parker two-stage modeling. Let's just let beta go. Let's just try to find that value, very best value beta, and see what we can do. So I think that's an excellent comment, and that's something that we really would like to go back again and see if we can't optimize things here a little bit more.
Yeah, the ABIC approach tries to find the optimum trade-off in an efficient way.
Yeah. So that's... Oh, I just wanted to make one comment here. So that was impedances, right? We can also invert apparent resistivities and phases. In the example I'll show you, we left out the phases for the diagonal elements because they were just all over. They were all over the map. We couldn't handle them. But in doing that, then we took the same block in half space and, you know, it converged in about the same amount of time. There's a slightly different number of data in the apparent resistivities and phases compared to the real and imaginary part, because we threw out some of the phases. But the convergence curves for both of them look about the same. And surprisingly to me, they came out in more or less the same time. In some of the controlled source work that we had done, working with the fields would converge faster if you worked them with amplitudes and phases of the fields, because you've got that other nonlinear operation was a bit slower. Apparent resistivities and phases were a bit slower yet. In this particular
I wonder if you tried your little tangent trick show yesterday.
Yeah, I stayed a little bit.
Because I bet on that previous slide.
So here's where we'll probably do that. So these were the phases that we had for that one and that one. And then when you transfer them back and just use the tangent, I mean, look at that's beautiful. I mean, of all the images here, certainly that the phase is a lot nicer image of the block, okay, than this guy here.
Did you just like think to try it?
Yeah, I just looked at it. It was just before we came to the meeting and we were looking at these things and I thought, God, those are crazy. And then we just looked at the these and thought, well, you know, the real and imaginary part. Up here, just looked at the real and imaginary part, and just like, those are really quite similar. They're just changing in sign. So we just plotted them up with the tan function and ended up with that. So I guess that's about it. Just to quickly summarize. Yeah, sure.
What happens if you don't have the mini station?
Fewer stations, it's actually easier to recover. You might not get as good a result out, but at least with our objective function, we tend not to get things that are like really oscillatory. There is invariably with electric fields, there's a chance to put structure up close to the electrode. It doesn't seem to be a severe limitation, and the examples that we'll show later on will just have, you know, rather a few lines of data.
Do you do vertical fields at all, Doc? Or is that easy to add in?
It's very easy to add in. We never did. That's again that's another one on the list to do.
The second one of the questions: is anybody going to show an L curve? Are we going to discuss L curves at any point?
Trade-off
parameter, so what's the right value to choose? You know, you're trading off roughness against misfit.
I don't think it's a tricky question. And I think a lot, it's not as simple as saying, well, on this, I think you really have to look at the model you get as well, just where you are. So I think you need there's some subjectivity that goes into that.
I would agree. We've used the L curve. We use it standardly in DC resistivity inversion. But we've done GCV, L curve, and deterministic Tikhonov curve, right? None of them are a panacea. And Randy is exactly right. You, irrespective of which one you're looking at, that's just your first guess. Like that. Look to see what you get out for a regularization parameter. look to see what your model is like, and then try to make some assessment of like, okay, I can get more out of these data. I can push them a little bit more, or maybe I've already pushed them too much. But those things are just your first guess. And the L curve, I mean, is just really a heuristic. It's all it was meant to be. We found that it works rather nicely sometimes, but other times it's
well, for
difficult.
For those of us that work in the real world, it's an essential tool, because what you essentially want to do is try and determine your appropriate trade-off parameter for the data you have and the likely structure below, given the complexity of the structure. If you're in a sedimentary basin environment, you're going to have a very different trade-off than in a Canadian shield. So we generate the L curve coarsely and then choose a range and then really do a lot of iterations on that range that we found seem to be, the bend.
Yeah. I mean that's really reasonable, but it's not it's not fundamentally different than just working with a Tikhonov curve and say, well, I'm gonna try for this value of regularization and then I'm gonna try for this one. I guess the other thing about the L curve that we've found is that, again, it's important to stick your neck on the line and make sure you've got the right approximate errors, at least the relative errors for these things. Because if you don't weight the errors in a relative sense properly, then that'll skew the L curve.